Vested Finance is an SEC-registered investment advisor. The topics discussed and the opinions expressed in this podcast are purely for your information purposes. Furthermore, the material in this podcast is not intended to be investment advice and should not be relied upon to make any investment decisions.
Hi everyone, welcome to the first episode of the Vested Finance podcast. My name is Darwin Arifin, and I'm one of the co-founders of Vested Finance. My co-host for this podcast today is Kaihan Lin. He is the owner of that sultry voice you just hear just now. He's our colleague at Vested Finance and is based in Singapore. All right, Kai, what will we be discussing today?
Thanks, man. We'll be discussing Tesla not being included in the S&P 500, Airbnb's rebound, Snowflake, and others that are IPOing. We cover a lot of topics that we discuss in this podcast in our blog posts, which we will link in the show notes.
Awesome. Let's talk about Tesla.
Well, there was an unexpected bit of news about Tesla. Tesla's shares face a sharp drop of 7% amid news that they will not be added in this year's S&P 500. Now, the S&P committee is particularly concerned about their profitability metric and their 2020 outlook. For our listeners, can you expand upon what they mean by the profitability metric?
The question about profitability metrics that the committee is concerned about, it's actually alluding to Tesla's most recent earnings, last four quarters. There are actually a lot of requirements to be included in the S&P 500. One of them is that the company to be considered has to have four sequential profitable quarters. So one full year of profitability. Before this past four quarters, Tesla has never accomplished that. But somehow it did the last four quarters, despite COVID, despite its factory being shut down, both in China and the US, and despite in decline in consumer demand and issues with logistics. And the way they accomplished this was they almost kind of pulled a rabbit out of their hat. They did it with regulatory credit. Now, regulatory credits are revenue that they've generated by selling carbon credits to other car makers specifically. So this is pure profit. As you can imagine, as emission standards all over the world, in the US and especially in California, is going up, some of these other car makers are not making enough fuel efficient cars to meet the standard. So they're in the negative. So in order to bring themselves back to meet the standards, they can buy carbon regulatory credits from other companies like Tesla. Tesla only makes electric cars, so they have a surplus of this. Now, as of Q2 of this year, they made about $428 million from regulatory credit. So that's about 8% of their total car revenue, which is almost triple of what it was last year. But it's really not their core business, right? It's not part of selling cars, and it may not be sustainable in the future because what if GM, Ford, or Honda, they got their act together and start selling electric vehicles, more electric vehicles, and they will not have to buy credit from Tesla. If you just look at the trend, the car revenue, which is should be the bread and butter for Tesla, it's actually flat on a sequential basis. From Q1 to Q2, it's flat. And compared to Q4 of last year, which is its peak, it's down. But a regulatory credit went up, so this allowed Tesla to be profitable. I think this is what the S&P committee means by questionable, profitable metric. Tesla appears to be getting profitable at all costs. So instead of choosing Tesla, the committee chose Etsy and a bunch of other companies. But it doesn't mean that the committee will not choose Tesla to be included in the next rebalancing, which they actually hold discretion for the ability to do this anytime. But one thing that's concerning for Tesla is actually Elon Musk is due a massive share bonus, and on the income statement, it has to be categorized as a expense. So if this happens, when this happens, actually, because the threshold to get to getting these bonuses for Elon is to achieve certain market caps for Tesla, which they have surpassed. If this happens, then Tesla profitability will be negative. I think the numbers is like they cannot be more than negative 268 million in the next quarter as to not break that profitability streak, cumulative profitability streak to be included in the committee in the S&P 500 index.
All right, Darren, can you let us know why is being added into the S&P 500 so important?
it's great for the company because when you're added to the index, you are broadening investors. Now more institutional investors will be owning Tesla because it's part of the index. More ETFs and mutual funds who track the index will have to, if they've not done so already, add the shares to their own portfolio holdings because it's part of the index. So this actually creates some sort of a buying pressure weeks before the actual inclusion date. And this actually can increase the price for a short period of time.
All right, let's shift gears and talk about some upcoming IPOs, specifically on Airbnb. They faced a massive drop in revenue and they had to retrench more than a quarter of their workforce. Now, this is inevitable considering COVID and all industries are being harshly affected, especially in tourism, hospitality. Now, that being considered, they are doing much better compared to other companies. Recently, though, Airbnb has rebounded, but their valuation is only half of what it used to be in 2017 at $18 billion. And yet they still plan to IPO. Does this seem to be the right move?
The right move is actually for the company to IPO in maybe Q3 or Q4 of 2019 because the market was doing really well and the business of Airbnb was doing great back then. I think they have to IPO for several reasons, but I'm not certain that they will achieve that lofty valuation of $37 billion that they acquired last year. So just take a step back. In Q1 this year, during the midst of the pandemic and the global lockdown, Airbnb was forced to raise money from private equity because they're experiencing liquidity crunch. As you mentioned, 90% revenue drop and they let go 25% of their workforce, right? So they were a little bit desperate. The terms that they raised their funds in Q1 were actually quite unfavorable for the company. It's $1 billion and then there's a 10% interest plus whatever the LIBOR is, and then warrants that can be converted into shares up to 1% equity. Overall dilution is not that much, maybe 1% to 2% equity, but it's still pricey because it's about, implied valuation was about $18 billion, about half of what it was maybe three quarters ago. But now it seems like the company has regained its footing. It's a segment of travel must have rebounded strongly for the company to regain confidence to be able to go to public. So I think this is what's happening. Due to COVID, people are not traveling. People are not traveling internationally. People are not traveling to big major cities. Think about New York, San Francisco, and so on. Big major international destinations. And this is why hotels and airlines are really not recovering. But luckily, Airbnb has a diversity of supply. They have a supply of lodgings everywhere. And the one segment that is rebounding strongly, it seems, is the segment of rural lodging. So people looking for places to stay away from other people. This is people in New York leaving New York City because they don't want to be cooped up in their apartment for 2 to 3 months during the lockdown. This is people from San Francisco. In fact, a lot of our colleagues, because they're all tech workers, are leaving the city to move to other areas, San Diego, Salt Lake City, or even more rural areas to just get more space. I think this is what Airbnb is seeing. We don't know the details, but it sounds like the numbers for June of this year is even stronger of June for last year for this segment of the travel. So it must be good enough that the company can continue its IPO process.
Well, Darwin, you beat me to it. I was going to tell you patience is a virtue, but it seems like they know what they're doing. Now, are there any other reasons why they would want to IPO sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I think one of the other key reasons that the company is IPOing this year is the options that the company granted its early employees that are expiring this year. So typically when you, as an employee of an early stage startup, you are given stock options, but these expires within 10 years. It's been 10 years since those options were issued. So I think Airbnb wants to do the right thing for its employee and proceed with IPO this year to meet that obligation.
That makes sense. Now let's move on to news on company IPOs. News on company IPOs always get investors on the edge of their seats. We know that Palantir is a data and analytics company, and they're also going to do an IPO. But what they're saying they're going to do is a direct listing. So for our listeners, what are the differences between direct listing and traditional IPOs?
So there are actually quite a bit, but the most important difference is direct listings. You're actually selling shares from the insiders of the company. So it's founders, employees, early investors, they sell their shares to the public market. That means the proceeds from the sales does not go to the company. It goes to the insiders. You do not raise new cash for the company. And the company does not issue shares, typically. Traditional IPO is the opposite. The insiders actually cannot sell for a specific period of time called the lockup period. And the company issues new shares to new investors, the public investors, and it generates fresh capital, fresh cash to run its operations. That's the two biggest difference. Now, typically, a direct listing has been dormant for a while, and it was brought back by Slack and Spotify, two premier business-to-consumer company, right? Because you kind of have to have some sort of brand awareness, strong brand awareness to be able to do direct listing because you don't do a roadshow. So typically direct listing is for companies who have brand awareness in the market. So you think about Slack, you think about Spotify. These are two of the most recent successful direct listings. What's interesting is Palantir is neither of those. Palantir is a data analytics company, as you mentioned, and it has 125 customers. Typically, they are large corporations and or government entities. So it's not a household name. Not a lot of people have heard of the company. It's interesting that it's choosing the direct listing path where the insiders can sell their shares. Another interesting thing about Palantir is that in its 17 years of existence, it has not posted a profit. I think not all technology companies are created equal. If you look at Palantir's business, it's very data heavy. It takes data from its customers or from its other multitudes of sources, and then it ingests, it's normalized, it processes. All these work requires data scientists, requires computer engineers, and so on and so forth. It's likely that for different customers, they have to do this. So it's likely that on an ongoing basis, it might be that the business has higher variable cost than a traditional software like Snowflake or Asana, where you just write code once and then you can sell it 1,000, 1,000,000 times with minimal marginal cost.
Actually, there was a comment that you made regarding Palantir, and you said that over the 17 years that they've been in existence, they have not posted a profit. To me, that seems puzzling, because if I'm a company and I don't turn a profit after so many years, I don't think I would be able to continue functioning. And yet you have this business that still is functioning. How does that work? Why hasn't the business failed?
Well, as long as it has cash on its books, it can fight another day. But the question is, can you generate enough cash for the next milestone before the cash runs out? So far, Palantir has been a private company. It was co-founded by Peter Thiel, a multi-billionaire with a large influence. Conceivably, they were able to continue to craft a narrative of growth that enabled them to fundraise from the private market. But typically, the public market is not as patient. I mean, you look at Uber, finally, the public market ran out of patience over Uber's overexpansion and the need to go back to profitability. And that might be true for Palantir once it goes public. There are certain exceptions, though. For the longest time, for example, Amazon was barely eking a profit or oftentimes negative profitability for the course of 20 years. But it was because public investors knew what Jeff Bezos was doing and believed in his vision. Jeff constantly poured money into the business for research and development, infrastructure build out, logistics, warehouse, and all this stuff that made the business super defensible. But over that long stretch of time, as it continues to pour money into the business, it didn't really generate a significant amount of profit. Therefore, it didn't really get taxed on those profits, because Jeff believes that he is a better wielder of capital, and that has been proven true. So they invested in the business. But Amazon has a very strong cash flow business through its e-commerce operations. It generates enough cash flow to continue to fund its operations.
Great. Thanks for clarifying. Could you tell us a little bit more about Snowflake? Their Q1 growth at 149% stands out from the pack, even though they're sustaining losses compared to 2019. Why is this a good thing?
Yeah. So Snowflake makes a suite of tools and software that allows their clients to not be trapped in one data silo. So for example, if you're a big company, say Johnson & Johnson, you want to migrate to the cloud for your data storage, database, and a lot of your software. So you choose Amazon's AWS, Amazon Web Services. But to move from one data provider, cloud provider, to another, it's very time consuming. It's very expensive. So what Snowflake creates, this layer of software that you can shift and migrate seamlessly in between the different data cloud providers. Now, so what's really cool about this company is when you compare it to the slew of upcoming IPOs, it's, as you mentioned, the revenue growth is very fast, but also the efficiency. So in order to measure efficiency in a software as a service business, one useful metric is the net dollar-based retention. So what this means is that, let's say I'm Johnson & Johnson and I'm spending $100 this month for services of Snowflake. By the same month of next year, if Johnson & Johnson has spent $120, that means the net dollar-based retention is 120%. This means the business is efficient because now the company can grow its revenue without investing in sales and marketing and customer acquisition. Your existing customer spending more on your services, maybe because it uses more services, maybe because it upgrades to a higher premium service and so on and so forth. But that makes the business very efficient. So Snowflake's number for this net dollar-based retention is 158%, which is really high. I think previously the highest I've seen was Zoom around its IPO was around 140%. Asana is another company, which is a kind of a project management tool founded by former Facebook co-founders, is at 120%. And the industry median from Crunchbase is about 108%. So 158% net dollar-based retention is very high. And I think the second point that's really interesting about Snowflake is the growth of profit versus expenses. As you mentioned, it's still negative, has negative cash flow and negative profitability, but the profit growth is trending upwards. And while the quarterly operating expense growth is declining much, much more rapidly, it seems like they have a path towards a positive cash flow.
Well, what does it mean for the trend to diverge like that?
It's actually a very encouraging sign. This means that they're starting to find their groove. The business is getting a little bit more efficient. When you're, and this is true not just for Snowflake, it's true for a lot of different software businesses that generates revenue from a subscription basis, recurring revenue. So you spend upfront, you spend a lot of money developing, hiring engineers, creating infrastructure, creating the actual software and the product. And then you hire a very expensive sales team and then you have to incentivize them. And it takes time to sell these services. So at the upfront, you spend a lot of money on variable and fixed cost. But then the revenue is actually spread out over a long period of time. Back in the day, they used to sell software in a box at $60 a pop. Now, for an equivalent software, it's probably a $5 to $10 subscription per month, but in perpetuity. So what this means for a software as a service company, you can create a snowball effect. In the beginning, your cash flow is super negative. Your profitability is bad. But as you gain more and more customers, and as time progresses, you have more and more of these recurring revenue that expands and then it snowballs. That seems to be the path that Snowflake is following. I mean, the future is uncertain, so we don't know what's going to happen. But that's, to me, when I see that diverging path, that's what that means.
Thanks, Darwin, for the conversation. We'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to our inaugural podcast. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. For more insights into markets and emerging technologies, please visit our blog at blog.vested.co.in. Take care and stay safe.